Just ask Satchmo about Bix. He'll say, tell the whole world there'll never be another Bix Biterbeck. He was a born genius, but they crowded him too much with love. This is Bix, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and produced by Miami University Radio. Autumn of 1923 found Bix Biterbeck in Chicago. There he joined a group of musicians. The guitarist for the group, Eddie Condon, tells of his first impressions of the Kid with a Cap.
When I first met Biterbeck, he had on sort of a, I wouldn't say raggedy overcoat, but it looked like he stole it. It didn't look custom tailored. And he had a cap. And I think I mentioned this, and that we call it music. Anyhow, I saw this guy. I met him at the LaSalle Street Station when we were walking. We had some time between trains. From Chicago, we took a train something like 1 o'clock in the morning to Syracuse, New York. Well, we made a couple of stops in Chicago that night. That's when Louis Panica was playing cornet with Isham Jones at the College Inn, which is now called the Panther Room, at the Sherman House in Chicago. And we had some time to kill, 2 or 3 hours, so some of these guys said, let's go in here to Louis Panico. At that time, Louis Panico was the big guy as far as cornet players are concerned. You recall Louis Panico, I Got Hot Lips and some other song that he more or less put in business. We went over there and heard him, and I still haven't heard Bix play the cornet yet. I always heard him as Biterbeck. Bix, to me, is a hell of a name. Everyone refers to him as Bix. I always refer to him as Biterbeck. Biterbeck this, Biterbeck that. And from there, we went over to the Friars Inn. At that time, the Friars Inn Orchestra, the Friars Inn was the name of the cafe over in Adams and Wabash, I think, in the Loop area, and we went over there. And when we got in there, the guys all knew Biterbeck, who formerly played on those Mississippi riverboats. Rapolo, Paul Maris, and so on. George Brunus. So we got to the Friars Inn, and we got in there, and the guy said, Bix, what do you say? Hello, Bix. And I thought, well, this guy must be somebody, because these guys all know him, and this is the best man in town, best man anywhere at the time. So I thought, well, this guy must have some idea what's going on. Due to the fact that these guys were in the best band in Chicago. So, sit in, Bix. I thought, oh, I want to hear this guy play the cornet now. So we got up to the bandstand and sat down and played the piano. I thought, oh, no. It made me more perplexed than ever. I heard him play the cornet the following day. We took a train out that night, the sleeper. So I guess somebody, in those days, everyone had traveled, brought their own jug along. So we got in the, we'll say the club car, had a banjo, Bix had the cornet, and there's a fellow named Wayne Hostetter, who had a clarinet. And the three of us sat down and played. Well, that's the first time on this train the following day, after we left Chicago, that I heard Biterbeck play the cornet. As I told you about Friars Inn, I'm going to sit there and say, oh, and I want to hear this guy. And they're raving about, wait till you hear this guy play the cornet. So he sat in and played the piano, so I'm still in the dark. So the next day on the train, he played the cornet, and he certainly quoted me verbatim on this. It's one of the, not one of the, it's the biggest musical feel I ever had. Because I was in doubt, see, I'm in the pitch dark about this guy on the cornet, after these guy, other guys tell me, where do you hear him play the cornet, where do you hear him play the cornet? So the next day, I heard him play the cornet, and it was the biggest thrill I ever had in the music business. And I've heard some guys in the music business, haven't I? Mm.
And so Pee-wee Rank, Wayne Hostetter, Johnny Eberhardt, Eddie Condon, and Bix Beiderbecke found themselves on their way to Syracuse, New York, and to a job at the Alhambra Ballroom there. Shortly after the job in Syracuse folded, Vic Moore was gathering jazz men for a group at the Stockton Club. The speakeasy was located on the Dixie Highway between Dayton and Cincinnati, Ohio. Dud Meekum was the piano player there for a while, and he tells how the group got the job.
Red Bird had been working with Bernie Cummins down at the Stockton Club. And Bernie did something to anger the owners down there, and they threw him out. And you remember Buster Locke, the trombone player? Mm-hmm. Well, he and Red decided to take the job over. They just jacked Bernie Cummins up and run the job out from under him. Mm-hmm. So Red came to me and asked me if I'd want to work with him. I was in here from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And somehow Locke got lost. But Red said, I know a good clarinet man. This was Jimmy Hartwell. Mm-hmm. He's in Indianapolis, and we can get him. He had called him on my phone. So we went up and got Jimmy Hartwell. He was a case. He was locked in the hotel. He wouldn't let him take his bag. He wouldn't even let him leave. But anyway, we brought him back. We bailed him out, paid his hotel bill. And then he proceeded to bring his cronies in, who consisted of Bob Gillette and George Johnson and the bass man I told you about, Ole Vangsness, who was a dentist, and later went back to Oak Park and practiced dentistry. He was probably older than the other boys. We mentioned their age, and I think they were around somewhere between 18 and 20, say. And so they come up with this good tenor man, George Johnson, and Jimmy Hartwell, clarinet, good clarinet, and Bix. That let Red out, because Red didn't fit. Red didn't play that type of music. Mm-hmm. And they all seemed to know each other. Mm-hmm. And made me feel like an outsider, for instance. And I think Gene Hulse sat in with us, anyway, before Bob Gillette came down. And, of course, Dick Voino replaced me. And the odd thing with those guys, he said, you going back to Chicago, you'll starve. We just came from there. Mm-hmm. And strange, but I'm going back because this is on the way out. Mm-hmm. Of course, this club was run by bootleggers, and the manager was a guy from Chicago, a roughneck. Well, anyway, every instrument to him was a joint. He'd say to the time, play something on that joint, or play a little on the joint with the banjo. And so when closing time came, which would be around 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd proceed to go change his clothes and go out and hijack liquor trucks. That was his second calling. After managing the club, he hijacked liquor trucks. Oh, he was something else.
The membership of the group settled at 6. They included Bob Gillette on banjo, Dick Voino on piano, George Johnson on sax, Jimmy Hartwell on clarinet, Beiderbecke on cornet, and Min Lybrook on the sousaphone, which was then sometimes called a bass. The newly formed group had a very limited repertoire, and this fact played a role in their choosing the name Wolverines.
No, just another group, but it's all no name mm-hmm. anymore. And ours had a name. We didn't have a name. Mm-hmm. The Stockton Club Hotshots or something. No, we didn't have a name. And they didn't have a name. But when it came time to acquire a name, I think probably for the Jeanette setup over there, they called themselves the Wolverine Band. And I said, why'd you call it the Wolverine Band? Because that's the first tune we learned to play in for a long time. The only tune we knew how to play. I mean, organized. Of course, the rest of it they faked, and each guy took a chorus and ad-libbed around. But this one, they could play three-part harmony on. And they would learn to play tunes four bars at a time. I said, my God, I can't stay around here. You learn a whole tune. It's going to take a month or two. That's the way they did. You know that? And Bix would arrange it, and he would give each guy his note for the harmonies.
Youthful vigor, enthusiasm for their jazz, and the long hours of playing at the Stockton Club welded the Wolverines into a unit. They repeated their limited repertoire from 9 each evening until the club closed, sometimes as late as 5 a.m. Each player could anticipate almost precisely which breaks each of the other men would take. The Wolverines were different from earlier Dixieland combinations in that each member had options and freedoms within the framework of a piece. And Beiderbecke's restrained riffs certainly lent the Wolverines a great deal of their glory. Olivia Irwin also knew Dud Meekham and the Wolverines during their days at the Stockton Club. Here, she gives some insight into the recreation Bix found at jam sessions.
When I was playing at the theaters and little dance groups around here, and the Beeler's Corner was always the hangout for the people, the musicians that would be uptown. And my friend Priscilla Holbrook Johnson, who played here in Cincinnati, we met one Sunday afternoon, particularly that I can think of, and we decided to go to my home on Millville Avenue and have a little jam session. And that's when Bix Beiderbecke and Bob Councilman were over at my home. Priscilla, I don't know who else was over there at that time. But my only impression of him was that we were all in a group. And when you have a jam session like that, of course, everybody is there for one particular purpose. You have a common interest. And more or less it's a rapport. Everybody feels the same thing. But he was with the group, but he wasn't one of us.
He never was.
He never was.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't collar that boy.
No.
He was. I wouldn't say aloof exactly,
no.
But he just didn't join in like the rest of them.
That's right. And we would play a number, and we would be all thrilled about,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he would just look out into space, and first thing you know, he would be at the piano, and he'd say, "Listen at these weird.
Yeah.
Weird
yeah.
chords." And he never heard a melody, I don't think, like anybody else did.
No,
he
didn't.
He always heard it in these weird progressive chords.
He had something in his skull that was not like anybody
right.
else.
I think anybody, any of the composers, I think, would have to be thinking 30, 40, 50 years ahead of time. And I think that's what he was doing. He was thinking in progressive jazz the way they are playing it today.
Yeah,
I think he was just.
That's right. He was way ahead of his time.
That's right.
Do you remember a book he had called Eastwood Lane's Woodland Sketches?
Indeed, I do.
He was Adirondack Sketches.
Was that it? I thought it was Woodland Sketches. Well, anyway, he gave that to me.
He did?
Yeah. And that's where a lot of his ideas came from.
Oh.
A lot of his ideas. He used to talk to me about playing on the riverboats. And I think that's where he met Louis Armstrong.
Oh.
On the riverboats. And you could see, for the short time that I worked with him, the influence of the way those guys play. They take one course and they play it till the whites of the eyes. I mean, they just keep going and going and going, and they keep getting a little softer, and then pretty soon they get real loud, and they all on one chorus. Mm-hmm. And that's the way Armstrong and that gang were playing back mm-hmm. in those days. And they still do, I think.
New Year's Eve brought a brawl at the Stockton Club. Rival mobs from Cincinnati and Dayton had each planned parties at the club, and a fight erupted to the lively strains of the Wolverines' China Boy. Mid flying glass and bullets, the Stockton Club came to its end. And with it ended the first stage of the Wolverines' career. The band packed their things and moved to Doyle's Dance Hall in Cincinnati. The lure of job offers from college fraternities and others prompted the Wolverines to leave Doyle's and to change their center of operations to Indianapolis. From there, the Wolverines traveled to Bloomington, Indiana, to play several college dates under the sponsorship of Hoagy Carmichael. But Indiana University was not the only one to enjoy the lively Wolverine style. The college group at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, hired the band for their prom in January 1924. Francis Hannaford, a student at Miami at the time of the Wolverines' debut there, recalls the impact of the experience.
The junior prom was a big social event of the entire year, and the money expended on a band far exceeded any of the other dances throughout the year. The two orchestras were hired, the Wolverines and another band, the Ohio Nine from Defiance, Ohio. The great reaction of the MIMA students there at the dance was the amazement of the vitality and the insistent energy that the Wolverines brought to their music. Oxford at that time, MIMA University, had never had access to any hot music. The phonograph records that were available were of the type that would be profitable for a phonograph record selling store to stock, and hot music was very nearly unknown. So when the Wolverines came on with this terrifically new, vitalized, energetic music, our horizons of dance music were expanded. The rest of the year, any fraternity dance committee chairman was begged to get a band that played like the Wolverines. This was a near impossibility because the Wolverines by that time were under Hoagie Carmichael's sponsorship to a degree, and he had them booked over at Indiana University for weekend after weekend that spring of 1924. Ones who had any musical knowledge on the campus tried to analyze this new sound of the Wolverines. I particularly remember John Sloat, who was a banjo player and a student orchestra, the Campus Owls, which incidentally still exists this many years later. And John Sloat, after the dance, sitting in front of the fireplace at the SAE fraternity house where I lived, shook his head and over said that sock time. A young freshman who was a very able trumpet player said that trumpet player, and of course the name of Bix Beiderbecke had never been heard in our circles before. He says that trumpet player, his tone and his timing. Sloat and Smith, with their insistence on praising the band, sort of took the play away from the conventional and usual after-dance conversations about who had this date with what girl. And so the music, for the first time, got into general conversation, and the stressing was of this new hot band, this new revolutionary, and a revelation is another word for what dance music could be. The Campus Owls, from then on, began to try to revamp their former style and imitate the Wolverines as best they could. Their qualifications weren't of a level that allowed them to get near it, but their goals, at least, were to play the music the Wolverines played.
3 weeks after their date at Miami, the Wolverines traveled to Richmond, Indiana. There, in a studio next to the railroad tracks, they cut their first recording. Frank Powers, a jazz aficionado from Cincinnati, comments on the various aspects of the Wolverines' recording of Fidgety Feet.
In February of 1924, they made their first recordings in Richmond, Indiana. At that time, Star Piano Company had a recording studio in Richmond, and Jeanette was active in recording some of the classical hot jazz of that period. The Wolverines made this trip to Richmond, Indiana, after the job, and the wee hours. And I would imagine a trip of this nature in those days probably took 3.5 to 4 hours, made two sides, and they were their initial recordings. The first of these selections was Fidgety Feet. On the recording of Fidgety Feet, we hear a typical Dixieland ensemble band of that period. It's only slightly more unique than the work of the New Orleans Rhythm Kings or possibly the original Memphis Five. The presence of Bix does give the ensemble a certain looseness that was probably markedly radical when compared to other bands at that time. However, to modern ears, it's quite ordinary sounding. There's very little solo work at all, except for, I believe, Jimmy Hartwell's low register clarinet solo, which is in the tradition of this particular type of band. This is Middle Western White Jazz 1924, and its uniqueness when compared to later recordings by the Wolverines is not too pronounced.
The same Richmond session found Jazz Me Blues recorded.
This must have been a bombshell. We hear a chorus by Bix Beiderbecke. Although on this particular record, when compared in terms of the later recordings of Wolverines, again falls short of being truly unique. Bix's chorus, though well conceived, is quite mathematical, does not take extreme liberties with either chord structure or melody, and is by comparison with his later work quite ordinary. However, it is Bix's first chorus on recording, and as said before, it was probably extremely unique when compared to what was going on at that time.
Thank you.
Bix Beiderbecke left a strong impression on those who knew him in the early Wolverine days. No one forgot him or was left unimpressed by his ability. But even those who knew him best were unable to clearly define his impact or his personality.
He wasn't exactly happy. He didn't have, what do you want to use a word, like rapport?
That's right.
He didn't have it.
I think all of those people have, they have no one who is close to them.
No, they
nobody
don't.
Nobody that they can talk with, nobody that they have, and as I say, they're so far out.
They don't understand how they feel.
No, that's right. Nobody.
A straight guy especially, he can't understand how they feel.
Mm-hmm. That's right. His creative, he thinks differently. He cannot have any rapport with any person, even in his own field.
No, that's right.
He's alone, absolutely alone. His compositions that were going around here in his head, and he'd play it, and nobody could say, oh, that's marvelous, that's great, and everything, because they couldn't feel the way he did. He was just completely alone. He was isolated in a group. That's all you could say about him.
He had phrases that nobody else would think of. He didn't have much tone. He didn't have much range, but he talked to you. Brother, he told you right from the heart what he was thinking. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It was just... What people call today soul music.
Yeah.
That was what he had
it was
on
soul music.
That's
then.
Right, soul music on the clarinet. That's right. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's right. He
tremendous did. Rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
He never lost any sign of a beat. Mm-hmm. No matter what he did, he was there right on it. Always.
This is Bix, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Consultants for the series were John Steiner, along with Joseph Campbell and Philip Evans. Commentary was recorded by Frank Powers. Continuity was written by Mary Kay Fulton. Audio engineer, Michael J. McGuire. Bix was researched, produced, and directed by Jim Grover. This is Bill Utter speaking for Miami University Radio.
Limited rights for this rebroadcast of Bix on WMKV 89.3 FM Cincinnati were given by WMUB FM, Miami University Broadcasting in Oxford, Ohio, courtesy of WMUB FM General Manager Cleve Callison. WMUB FM originally produced the program for broadcast in 1971. Any rebroadcast, internet streaming, or archiving of this program by anyone other than WMKV is prohibited. WMKV would like to thank the original producer of the program, Jim Grover, for his vision and efforts to preserve this unique chapter in the history of jazz, authored by Bix, and Mr. Bill Utter, Director Emeritus of Miami University Broadcasting, who conceived the original program idea, narrated the original series, and has been instrumental in making this rebroadcast possible. Dave Bartholomew, volunteer and host of the WMKV weekly program Friction, deserves special thanks for his labor of love in remastering Bix. The advisory group that oversaw the project to rebroadcast Bix include Frank Powers, commentator on the original series, Dave Bartholomew, Bill Utter, Cleve Collison, WMUB General Manager, Dave Schramm, WMKV Coordinator of Online Services, Mike Farrar, WMKV Coordinator of Production Services, Joe Schooner, WMKV Intern from the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, Media Division, and Alan Bayoski, WMKV General Manager. Please stay tuned for the best in big band era music right here on WMKV, the way radio was meant to be.